Talk given Friday, 26th January, 1973. All the great religions of the world have presented the concept that the realization of transcendence means immortality for him through whom such realization takes place. It is one of the very significant points in connection with all the deep religious teachings that death is the great enemy. Death and sin go together. Mortality is what one overcomes, to use the usual word in the religions of the past. And immortality is that which one realizes. And in this realization of immortality, through realizing transcendence, there is ineffable bliss. We find great affirmations throughout all the scriptures. Affirmations whose deep significance has been missed by the millions, because in all probability they are far too deep. We have, for instance, in the Bible, and Enoch walked with God, and Enoch was not, for God took him. It is never said of Enoch that having lived so many years, he died. But perfectly obviously, whatever being or person was represented by that name Enoch did die, like you and I die. They talk of Elijah, when he was walking with Elisha and talking together. And they were talking together. The chariot of fire appears, and Elijah is taken up to heaven in this chariot. We have the ascension, resurrection and ascension of Jesus after the crucifixion. In the Rig Veda, we have statements like this. The Rishi Pragatha sings, "We have drunk Soma and become immortal. We have attained the light. We have discovered the gods." Then again, throughout the Upanishads, there is statement after statement of this type. When one is liberated from all the knots, K-N-O-T-S, knots of the heart, it is immortality that one finds. In the Kena Upanishad, for instance, when one awakens to it, it standing for Brahman, it is immortality that one realizes. In the Mundaka Upanishad, he crosses over sin and sorrow. He becomes immortal. In the oldest of the Upanishads, it is said, that is the Aitareya Upanishad, it is said that Vamadeva, having said this, that is what goes before in the Upanishad itself, Vamadeva, having said this, ascended aloft and became immortal. Yea, became immortal. Again and again in the Upanishads you find the statement that so and so having realized the Atma, or having become Brahman, attained immortality. In the great mysticisms of Christendom and Sufism, we find statements regarding the unio mystica, the union with God. What is the meaning of all these statements? And in this condition which is realized in one, there is the peace that passes understanding, there is bliss and so forth. What does it mean? Because we know for an actual fact in the world of affairs that any of the great teachers, all of them in fact, all the holy ones, they suffer physically, they suffer illness, they suffer because of the sufferings of other people, they suffer because they themselves undergo a tremendous conflict. Think of Jesus in the Garden of Gethsemane. That he, the sinless one, the perfect holy one, as we would quite legitimately say, he had to go through that agony so that the sweat broke forth. And every one of them dies. Then what is the meaning of saying one attains immortality and one knows ineffable bliss? Now, in connection with this, let us look into one of the oldest teachings of our whole Indo-European religious culture, which means looking back deep into the Rig Veda itself, which is the oldest religious monument of the Indo-European peoples. It is said that Yama chooses death, abandons his body, passes into the other world, and is granted lordship over the highest of the three heavens. Over the highest of the three heavens. He becomes the lord of death in the sense of becoming the master of death. Not to be misunderstood as becoming Mara, the deliverer of death. Mara is, or Mrityu in Sanskrit, Mara is the personified Diabolus, the devil, and the giver of death. But Yama becomes the lord of death, the master of death. He transcends mortality. He realizes immortality and is the first of mortals, as the Rig Veda puts it, who achieves this. Now, in connection with this story about Yama, bear in mind that other traditions have spoken in similar terms with a certain difference. In the Zarathustrian tradition, the Iranian tradition, we have Yima, who is in touch with Ahura Mazda, God himself. Finally, Yima through pride experiences a fall. and the glory of the Lord was seen to fly away from him. This comes in the what is known as the Zamyad Yest. In the Judaic tradition, we have Adam and Eve, who start off on speaking terms with the Lord, with God. And then there is a fall. In the case of Yama, and his counterpart is his twin sister, Yimak. Oh, I beg your pardon. Yami. Yama and Yami. Yimak is in the Zarathustrian tradition. In the case of Yama, there is no fall. But there is this statement, which I made a few moments ago, that he chooses death, abandons his body, enters the other world, and becomes... is granted lordship over the highest of the three heavens, the master of death, the first mortal to realize immortality. Now, let us try and understand what is the particular mortality that we human beings experience, apart from the death of the organism as such. But the mortality we experience in our everyday life. Our everyday life consists of a series of sense impressions. And all those sense impressions have words attached to them. During our waking life, there is a constant stream of silent talk as well as audible talk. This stream of words goes on perpetually, and this stream of words is associated all the time with our sense impressions, our sense functions, our desires, our planning, and so forth. And this stream is characterized by uprising in consciousness, by a procedure in consciousness, and then an ending in consciousness. When the stimuli which give rise to this stream have worked themselves out, we have gone through in consciousness the cycle of birth, life, temporary life, and death in consciousness. And we associate our almost always ill-conceived self, the I am I, with every single uprising, proceeding, and ending, with birth and death. This is the real meaning of samsara. The awareness of our existence in the birth-death terms of sense impressions and stimuli. This is the real cycle of births and deaths. And not the usual reincarnational picture. This is the real meaning of punna bhava, the again becoming. Now this is the mortality with which we are all afflicted. And this is the aspect of mortality which we can deal with. When the organism dies, that is a complete end of body-mind functioning. The totality goes on. The totality is neither more nor less than the totality. But the individual patterns, the multitudinous individual patterns, form and disrupt. They form and they disrupt. And they do not have any entity persistence. Entity persistence appears in our life insofar as the organism remains alive and our self-consciousness is associated with each single uprising, proceeding and ending. And this is the great cycle. Now, if this cycle were only a pleasant cycle, or exclusively an unhappy and miserable cycle, we would not know that the pleasant was the pleasant or the miserable was the miserable. It would be an absolute fact as such, wouldn't it? With no contrast to it by which we would be in a position to like or dislike, to choose or not to choose. But there is the contrast. Part of it is the likable, and part of it is the dislikable. And in the choosing, taking sides with the one against the other, there is the state of conflict. And not only is there the state of conflict, but we direct our energies towards perpetuating the desirable, which is the tremendous mistake we make. Because life will everlastingly present the alternation of the pleasant and the unpleasant. What can remain poised and perfect? Poised, not indifferent, not unmoved, but poised, master of the situation, is one's own individual awakened state. Now, there have always been those through the ages who realized that this stream of words, this stream of conversation, whether it was the silent chatter when we were not talking aloud, or whether it was the audible conversation when we are talking aloud, that this is the great stream of samsara, and that it is associated with our desires, with our worldliness, with our grasping for the pleasant, and our conflict against and violence towards the unpleasant. They realized that. And they saw that the whole of the terrible disharmony of life was entirely summed up in this process. Look into it sufficiently deeply, and you will see that this is the crux of the matter. Now, through the ages, the few who were keenly concerned with this experienced time and again a state of calm and peace when the sense functions were pacified in a peaceful state. When the different stimuli which came to them from outside or which arose from within themselves did not upset their balance, and they were able merely to look at the whole of that stimulus and understand its significance and learn their lesson from that stimulus. They also experienced this blissful condition when they were completely in tune with nature, in tune and not in ecstasies, not beside themselves, carried away by the beauty of nature, but in perfect inward poise. And in that perfect inward poise, there was an intensity of awareness and consciousness, which was of a totally different order of being and consciousness from the being and consciousness which was theirs in ordinary everyday life. They longed for proximity then with this something deeper, this something which lies at the very heart of all things, this eternal creative power which is the origin and also the end of all that we may experience throughout the entire becoming process, throughout the whole process of life, our daily life. And they learned what were the things that produced disharmony, all the defilements of the mind, the impurity of the psyche, the grasping at things which were in themselves essentially ephemeral, insubstantial, of no real worth. And they realized that their task was the complete reversal of worldly consciousness as far as the whole of their life was concerned. The transformation of that worldly consciousness, which is associated with pain and with death and with sin, the transformation of that consciousness into the truly spiritual, holy, pure consciousness. The awareness of eternal existence in a state of trans-consciousness, beyond discriminative consciousness, which exercises personal choice. They learned that. And they discovered various ways by which this came about. Basically, it is the foundation of purity. Purity of body, purity of mind, purity of heart. We have time and again looked into the meanings of purity of mind and purity of heart. Very briefly, what we call morality, in the supreme sense of the word, and freedom from all our preconceptions, assumptions, our prejudices, our biases, our intellectual conditioning, and so forth. Freedom from all that. Those were two essential elements in entering into this deeper state. And then, in those moments of quiet, which they experienced spontaneously, as well as in those moments which, through meditation, through contemplative prayer, to use the words, the phrase that the mystics use in Christendom, through contemplative prayer, they were able to enter deeper and deeper states of consciousness. That is to say, the consciousness which becomes free of the knowing process as we experience it in the world from moment to moment. The knowing process in the world from moment to moment is dependent upon and is due to the sense functions and the sense stimuli all the time, all of which give rise to this succession of patterns, mental patterns, the whole lot of them. And they all become calm and quiet. It is as if our worldly life is a perpetually stormy ocean in which our little ship is most likely to sink and we be drowned. But when this ocean becomes quiet, then something quite different happens. The simile is very limited in its application. When the ocean becomes quiet, you just sail on the surface of the ocean. But when this ocean of the mind and the heart becomes completely quiet, you not only sail on the ocean, but the whole ocean becomes luminous. And there is a richness of life, of a different order of consciousness, which we never know in our ordinary, stormy, worldly, limited consciousness state. Now we can see what is the meaning of Yama choosing death. He chooses to die to worldly consciousness, completely to die to all worldly consciousness. Then the next statement, he abandons his body. People will, and a great many people have done that sort of thing, will sort of spin out wonderful ideas about, oh, he floats away in his astral body or some such stuff, you know, and sees marvelous planes and worlds and angels and all kinds of things. But you see, all that is also turmoil. All that also belongs to the realm of the mortal, whose lord is death, the disruptor. Because they all come into being and they all perish. They all arise out of our own fancy and imagination, our impure intellect, the intellect in its state of impurity, and they undergo death, bringing sorrow to us, nostalgia, and grasping after passing experiences which are of no fundamental worth or value. Visions and auditions and whatnot and so forth. Oh no, away with all that. You die to all that. And you abandon the body. And the word body there stands not for this, but for all that stuff, body, stuff, which the mind throws up out of its sickness, out of its passion to have some super exciting, some super delightful experience. He abandons his body. Then he enters that inner world. Now he is in that inner world, which is no different from this world. The difference is just this, that the worldly consciousness has given place to that pure awareness of the one total reality, so that everything is absorbed in that awareness. And in that absorption, there is no disharmony, no disturbance, no grasping whatsoever. in Yama himself. In this state, there are no visions, no exalted, sublime ideas, experiences of any sort whatsoever. This is the absolute condition, the realized absolute condition. And he is granted lordship over the highest of the three heavens. He is in that state which, in connection with which, I like to use the word transconscious. 25 years ago, I used to use the word superconscious. But the difficulty is that the word consciousness is usually associated with, and it's very difficult to dissociate it from, discrimination. Consciousness implies discriminating. If I'm conscious of a chair, I have discriminated that from the other objects in the room, and so forth. This is an awareness, a sensitivity, an extraordinary sensitivity which has no relationship with what we know ordinarily as intellectual perception, howsoever deep, or any sort of discriminative consciousness. It is a pure awareness in which you are what you are aware of. In consciousness, obviously bodily you can't become the other object. But in consciousness, there is absolutely no separation. There is the realization of the one total reality. This is the meaning, if you like, of Enoch walked with God, and God took him, and Enoch was not. Of Elijah going up to heaven in a chariot of fire. This is the state of nirvana, of the kingdom of heaven, when all the entire flow of discursive thought, the uprising, proceeding and dying in thought, in consciousness, has completely ceased. It's settled down. The ocean is still and peaceful. But it's still with the extraordinary vibrancy of eternal life, a stillness which we know nothing about. The nearest physical analogy that I can give you in that connection is, when you spin a top, if you spin it absolutely perfectly at its highest velocity, you might hear a hum, but the top looks as if it is unmoving. So you see, in this state, there is no uprising, proceeding, dying. Birth and death are overleaped altogether. And you in yourself have gone right beyond mortality in consciousness. This is the actual experiencing of immortality. Now, if you're really wise, if you're really careful, you won't make the mistake of imagining that, now I know immortality. You never know it. You are it. That is all. Just as the eyes in my head cannot see themselves, but they are my eyes, so too, you are that immortality, that immortal state. But you never know it, in the sense of being able to give an analytical description so dear to discriminative consciousness. In that state, there is no such thing as time and space. There is no such thing as God or the Absolute or the Atma or the Brahman of our conceptions. In that state, all theologies and philosophies vanish. And the whole world stands still with the vibrancy of eternal life in fruition. Now this, as far as I'm aware, is something of the meaning of immortality. Now you can see what happens. In that state, oneself, the particular individual, has become quite free of all the limitations which his consciousness of his separate particularity imposes upon the totality. And the totality makes real the meaning of immortality through him. This is what happens. Immortality, therefore, can never be attained, although the Upanishads and so forth use the word attained immortality. It is nothing attained. It comes into being. The supreme mystery, and everlastingly remains the mystery. And that, if you like, if I may use such words, is the proof. I dislike the phrase in this context, is the proof of transcendence and its real nature. What the great religions have taught is not airy-fairy nonsense. It's not wishful thinking. It is no escape from reality. The attempt to escape from reality is irreligious, because it is the attempt to escape from that which eternally is, the truth itself. Therefore, it's not an escapist activity to be concerned with religion in this sense. So I say there is no God there. There is no space and time there. You yourself, who are the within the self infinite, are in complete union with God, the universal transcendent infinite. And that is the state which is blissful. The state which has no sensation to it, as we understand sensation. Neither pleasure nor pain. Neither joy nor sorrow. This is the supreme meaning of the word upekkha, which the Buddha uses as the climax, the supreme point of love, which starts with friendship, with loving kindness, which burgeons out into compassion, into joy, pure joy for the happiness and well-being, with the happiness and well-being of others, and then flowers finally in this state of upekkha. It's one of the incredible things in Hindu Buddhist teaching. It is not the teaching of the four aspects are not original to the Buddha. They are Hindu in origin, Brahmanical in origin. So this state is the blissful state, the state which cannot be described. It's ineffable. But whosoever is in that blissful state is the center of influence through him as an unresisting focus point of the energy of transcendence itself. And when a human being is in that state, he is the perfect human, the Son of Man, who is the Son of God. And in that state is the real fulfillment of the individual as the perfected, holy human being. That man is master of death. He is the Lord of death. How does his lordship over death function in everyday life? We have already seen that this mortality is the successive self-associations, the separate self-associations with all the sense impressions, with the stream of words that goes on associated with those sense impressions. This is the mortality. Now, the perfected Holy One does not cease to function as far as his senses are concerned. In fact, his senses are more alert, more keen than the senses of the ordinary man. Far more keen. He is far more receptive, he is far more responsive as far as his sense life is concerned. What's the difference then? There is not the slightest uprising of a separate self-association with that stream of the sense life. There is no stream of words which express a grasping, a planning, a discriminative choosing, a taking sides with what is agreeable against the disagreeable. Because in that lies conflict and death, which is pain. But because the perfected Holy One is completely alive, awake, completely aware of the entire becoming process in his own environment and situation, he completely lives out the whole of that situation without despoiling it through greed, through violence, through aversion, through illusions, through delusion, through ambition, envy, jealousy, or any of those things. He doesn't spoil it. He lets it go. He doesn't push it aside. He lets it move past. He does not interfere with the pellucid stream of life itself. It is transparent. It is perfect. Nothing is sullied by him. And in this state, one is blissful. In this state of awareness, of awakenedness, one is blissful. It is perfectly possible in this state to be in contact with all that is horrible and painful in life. Wars, pestilences, earthquakes, pain everywhere. And it may come to oneself too, one's own bodily pain. And so forth. Everything that touches the life of man and brings him sorrow and merely ephemeral delight, the perfected Holy One is sensitive to the whole of it. And he feels that with greater intensity than the imperfect, the unholy one. But he is blissful in the midst of it. You see the meaning of bliss? See, this immortal state which is within. This undying condition. This is the great transformer. And this teaching about Yama, I have tried to sort of develop it. There are just a few sentences only in the Rig Veda stating these facts. Just the facts of what he does. Chooses death, abandons his body, passes into the inner world and is given lordship over the highest of the three heavens and so on. Just a few sentences. Well, what it all means, and therefore, if we understand what it all means, it gives us the instruction what we have to do in our ordinary everyday life in order that transcendence may be realized, immortality may be realized, in order that this resurrection and ascension, this, as they said of Vamadeva, rising aloft and becoming immortal, takes place every moment of our life. Through each and every passing experience.